I'll let you get going. I do want to say a special thanks. I think that, and this is, they've done this for several, a number of years, probably more than I've been here, but Jeremy Jackson, Bill Hale, and Sean Reedy, and their podcast, these will all be up after the conference if you guys want to look at these or get a little better look at them. And Jeremy's post is www.sportsmedicinebroadcast.net, and I think it's on some of the revolving screens if you don't get that, but we want to thank those guys for doing that too, so appreciate that. And at that, I'll let David.
Morning, you guys. Our first speaker is Dr. Flores. He grew up in the San Antonio area and went to college at A&M and then on to Baylor College of Sports Medicine, or on to Baylor College of Medicine. He did his residency at Northwestern University in Chicago and then came back and did a sports medicine fellowship at Baylor College of Medicine. He is one of the team physicians for the Texans and Rockets and St. Thomas High School. And his clinics are located in Sugarland and TMC, and he will be here to talk to you about shoulders.
Thank you. All right, good morning. Thanks for everybody for coming out. This is obviously a way bigger room than last year or the years past. Every year, this is a little bit of a tough topic to try to figure out what to speak on, trying to find something that's educational and interesting, and those aren't, unfortunately, mutually inclusive terms. So I usually lean on Bob, who, again, I want to thank for having me speak again this year on what possibly would be best served for everybody in the audience. I know we have a big mix this year of athletic trainers and therapists, so we'll try to, I try to kind of tweak this talk a little bit from what's in your handout to something that may be benefit to everybody. So I have no disclosures. So we're going to go the background on several different topics, kind of hit the high points, some initial treatment management for, on the field or sideline, factors to consider when trying to make decisions, and then potentially, surgical options. But we'll try to minimize the role of surgery here, since that's probably entirely another day of speaking. So the shoulder is a very common joint to sustain injuries, up to 20% of all athletic injuries. It's a very fine balance between both muscles, ligaments, tendons, your dynamic and static stabilizers in the shoulder. And if there's not a balance between these structures, it can manifest as, pain, weakness, loss of performance, or in the case of instability, recurrent dislocations. It's fairly predictable in terms of age group, of usually what you're looking at. So we're going to focus more on this red highlighted area, so the younger population. So this group generally is going to be dealing with labral pathology or fractures. So that, is usually dislocations or some sort of traumatic event. You do occasionally see the repetitive overuse, especially in younger adolescents with growth plate injuries. But it's very uncommon to see rotator cuff tears or any sort of arthritic conditions, although as you get older, these conditions become more prevalent. So we'll start basically with traumatic injuries, and the bulk of this is dislocations, obviously, these can occur both with trauma or athletic activities. It's generally in collision sports, although you do see it occasionally in non-collision sports, such as baseball when you're sliding into a base. And you see it in soccer, you see it in football. It's usually when you're tackling. And the problem with this type of injury is that there's a very high recurrence in the young population. And the old thinking where you could just let kids play all year, have them dislocate every game, put it back in, and fix it at the end of the year, may be falling out of favor as we're beginning to learn more and more about how these individuals actually do once they get fixed. And the issue really becomes with treatment options once they present for definitive management. So most of these are going to be traumatic. Again, usually it's some sort of forceful impact or fall on an outstretched arm. Oftentimes in football, it's with tackling or sliding into a base. A very smaller subset's atraumatic with repetitive overuse. So this is generally your overhead athletes, so your swimmers, your tennis players, your volleyball girls. And oftentimes they're not really complaining of my shoulders popping in and out. It's more pain as a presenting factor or potentially even loss of performance. basic anatomy, which most of us already have an idea. So we're dealing with the labrum, which is the cartilage rim around the socket, the ligaments attached to that labrum, and they're just thickenings of the capsule. And then bone is probably where the last 10 years or so has really kind of focused, both on the glenoid or socket and on the humeral head. And these manifest either as Hill-Sachs lesions, which is your dent on the head, or any sort of glenoid fracture or wear. And the problem there is once you have injury to these structures, your surgical options now change, and your success of certain surgical options change. So anterior instability has the majority of these events. Again, generally contact sports, usually force applied to an abducted externally rotated arm. Posterior instability, much less common, usually fall onto an arm. It's fairly rare to have someone actually locked out posteriorly, although it does occur. Generally, probably a little more difficult to reduce back on the field. This is often more of a repetitive overuse type injury seen in offensive linemen or individuals doing a lot of weightlifting with pressing type activities. The classic, book question always, seizures, shocks, which we're not generally dealing with unless you have a kid with a known seizure disorder that might have this occur during an event or practice. Multi-directional instability, generally speaking, this is probably considered more of an atraumatic injury, but it's really just a term used to describe instability in more than one direction. So you could have somebody who's had a prior anterior event that they play with and then has a posterior event, or vice versa. We generally think of this more as these hyperlax, double-jointed girls, although, it's been shown to be probably equal in men and women. If someone is double-jointed or ligamentously lax, this probably does place them at an increased risk of having this. Treatment for this a little bit different than traumatic. So initial on-field management, ideally you want to identify the injury, with somebody in a full set of shoulder pads, that's going to be a little more difficult. A lot of times, especially the young athletes, a little hysterical, a little freaked out. If they've never had this happen before, if you've had an athlete who's had this occur, they generally know, hey, my shoulder's out, and oftentimes they can either put it back in. But the goal here is really to try to get it in as quickly as possible before muscle spasm comes into play. So if you can get it on the field, that's ideal. If you can't, either in the sideline or the locker room, and if you still can or you're uncomfortable, transfer to the emergency room to have this put in. Unfortunately, with these new doc in the box ERs that have popped up across town, a lot of times they're not equipped to do this. And I've had people who have shown up and said, "Yeah, I went to four ERs, couldn't get my," they said they couldn't help me, and they show up to clinic 4 days later with a shoulder dislocated in the office. So trying to figure out, appropriate care and management is ideal, because the longer this thing is out, the harder it's going to be to put back in, and the more potential damage you're going to have occur with this. So general reduction techniques, traction, I think, is going to be the mainstay of most of these, especially in the acute setting. Generally, if you can get athletes to relax, calm down, this is generally fairly successful. The next step would probably be traction, counter traction, generally probably off to the side or in the back. So you're not going to probably do this on the field. Obviously, if you have a much larger lineman, this can be a little more difficult. So having the assistance of other individuals sometimes can help to hold them down. A lot of times you just have to get them to fatigue their muscles to have it slide back in. Stimson technique, laying prone, this can be useful, especially if they've been out for a period of time or you can't get them to relax, and the general premise is just to get them to fatigue. Most of us don't probably have weights laying around, so even just a gradual manual distraction or traction on the arm with a general shoulder or scapular massage can have this reduce, and this has been pretty successful even in the clinic setting when people have come in dislocated for a period of time. Obviously, if these techniques don't work, then they need to probably be under a general or a conscious sedation or even general anesthesia to have it reduced, because what you don't want to do is obviously create more of an injury or a fracture, but generally fairly easy to get in early. Posterior dislocations, probably a little more difficult to identify. These are the ones that typically show up in the office unfortunately more common than not, still dislocated because they've been missed in an emergency room setting. You know, generally the arm's locked, so it's pretty easy to identify if you have a suspicion of injury. And the goal here is just to distract the head off the glenoid and reduce it back into the shoulder. After the game, you know, now we're talking about, you know, general management. So sling for comfort, you know, ice for swelling, and then, you know, scheduling some sort of follow-up just to discuss, you know, treatment options and a plan for, you know, really which direction to go. You know, there's lots of decision criteria that has to be thought of really if you're going to continue to play and really deciding whether or not additional imaging is necessary. A set of plain x-rays probably is a standard to make sure there hasn't been a fracture, and then deciding whether or not, you know, advanced imaging like MRIs or CTs is necessary. So the problem with these are there's really no definitive treatment. It's not everybody doesn't need surgery or everybody does need surgery or you need surgery in a week or you're in a sling for 2 weeks. You really have to base it upon symptoms, you know, pain level, apprehension. You know, the younger somebody is, maybe the more aggressive you potentially would want to be in treating this. The older someone is, the less likely they're going to have instability, but probably the more likely they may have either a fracture or a rotator cuff injury. And the thing that we all probably battle with is timing, whether or not, you know, you do something in season, out of season. Most kids, unfortunately, play multiple sports, so trying to figure out when's the best time can be a difficult conversation with the athlete, the parents, and everybody involved who tends to show up in the room when you're having this discussion, or in the training room when you're trying to figure out really what needs to be done. So traditionally, these have been placed in a sling, conventional sling, progress motion, progress strength, and allow them to return once they've had restoration of those issues and no longer have any sort of apprehension. There was a brief moment in time where external rotation bracing was really thought to possibly be a big new advent to help decrease instability events. I think these are still available. Some people still use them. The concept was really to have abutment of the labrum and capsule back to the glenoid to allow for improved healing. Unfortunately, there's conflicting support, not only clinically, but with cadavers and MRIs to either support or not support this. Probably used more in Japan, although these are available here in the United States through certain vendors. This is just one study that really showed minimal to no difference in a younger population of average age of 20. Years of age, and there was really no difference in redislocation rate. And this in a different study that did show a significant decrease, although these were all in older individuals who we generally don't feel are going to have a problem with instability. Rehab principles, we want to individualize the athlete, consider again their symptoms, their goals, their timing, whether or not they want to continue to play or not play. Whether or not, you know, baseball is their primary sport or football, or if they're just done playing sports. And we probably need to really consider the long-term health of the shoulder and really factor in if recurrent dislocations is something good for a shoulder, just like, you know, if trying to play with a meniscus tear or an ACL injury or a cartilage injury is good for the knee. We want to consider at least early physiologic healing. So like most things, you need some healing to occur, allow the shoulder to settle down, allow soft tissues to heal in whatever degree of laxity or tightness that it may occur, and then allow for pain-free strengthening and return of activity. And again, with more significant injuries, you probably need to go a little bit slower. Oftentimes, this can be elucidated on additional imaging. So the basis of this, and we won't get into specifics since I think there's other people here that are probably better to speak on this, but from a rehab standpoint, we're working mainly on rotator cuff and periscapular strengthening. So these are dynamic stabilizers. They allow for that concavity compression effect of the glenoid into the socket. Even with the best surgical repair, if you don't restore strength, you'll have recurrent instability. There are some individuals with really good strength who are stable despite having a labral tear. So, you know, strength is probably the most important thing here when factoring return to play. So again, scapular control is going to be the basis for the ball and socket concept. Again, closed chain exercise is probably the mainstay here. Proprioceptive exercises, which decrease after an instability event, would be, you know, a progressive activity. And then functional progression to restore motion and strength. And then obviously, depending upon their degree of instability, avoiding that provocative position at least early on. So again, early, we're going to strengthen based on motion and symptoms. Intermediate, we're going to progress. And then late, do more sport-specific type activity. And there obviously will be differences based upon positions and whether or not you can protect somebody after playing. So if you're a lineman, these can be braced. If you're a receiver, that's very difficult. If you're a quarterback and it's your throwing arm, obviously more difficult. If you play sports like basketball, tennis, swimming, obviously those are almost impossible to brace and potentially may need to be considered more for surgical intervention if they have recurrent events or apprehension. So to return to sport, again, ideally you'd like to have full motion or at least near full motion. You know, it's probably not unreasonable to accept a loss of motion in the provocative position or dependent upon your sport or activity or position. You'd like to have near full strength and really lack of apprehension, as apprehension in the cocking or abducted rotated position has been shown to be a negative factor for not redislocating. So how do we do with this? Fairly poorly, at least in the young population. So again, high recurrence rate, the younger you are, lower recurrence rate, the older you are. And again, the younger you are, males and return to contact or collision sports, in almost every single study out there has been shown to have a significant recurrence rate. And again, that rate's really directly related to the degree of pathology, the degree of any sort of bony lesion, and the degree of tearing that's present at the time of the initial event. So the initial event is really where the pathology occurs. With subsequent events, you can obviously have more trauma, more wear, and that factors in when we talk about treatment. So again, high recurrence rate, loss of function, potentially arthritic development. And so the big question is, and this is probably where the pendulum is potentially swinging, is should we operate on them early before they're really recurrent? Again, we know the rate of recurrence is high. If we operated on everybody, there's probably a small group that would get surgery that they may have not needed. But again, recommendation in those unwilling to modify activities, especially in this high-risk group, is for surgery. But again, trying to convince somebody to do that in season, I think, is difficult, but it probably needs to be given as an option at least, although most people will choose not to have it and do it at the completion of a season. So appropriate rehab is critical if these individuals are going to go back to play, and then potentially bracing to help minimize recurrence risk. So again, with surgical treatment, our goals are to reduce the episodes of instability. And again, with more instability episodes, there's more potential damage for cartilage and bone injuries. The more episodes of dislocations you have prior to an event or prior to a surgery, the poorer outcomes you're going to have with surgery. The more pathology you have prior to surgery, the fewer options you have from a surgical standpoint. And there's this new concept of subcritical bone loss. And so the general thinking was, hey, you can accept 20 to 25% of glenoid deficiency or glenoid bone wear. But some people think that as little as 12-13% of wear may place individuals at a higher risk for failure. So again, this is where things are switching. So in the ideal scenario, you'd like nice tissue, good bone, and have a nice, you know, simple repair. Whether or not you choose to do it arthroscopic or open, I think is you know, surgeon's choice or dealer's preference. Both do very well done appropriately. The issue becomes when you start having bony issues, such as this here, where you now may need to change your options as another arthroscopic or soft tissue procedure, either open or arthroscopic, is doomed to fail, especially in this high risk athletes. So on rehab, just briefly, you know, these, especially in this young group, these kids generally don't get stiff. They generally get their motion back too fast. And once they feel fine. They start doing things. So in my hands, I think they're better immobilized in a sling. You know, if you have somebody that you trust, or if you have an older patient, then obviously you want to probably be able to move them at least in that, you know, scapular plane to minimize stiffness. But generally, this teenage group doesn't get stiff. And then once you get a month out, you can kind of protect motion, obviously avoid a provocative position, progressive strengthening, and then kind of return to play depending upon sports. Contact generally 6 months, although in posterior instability, you might, you know, get away with a month or two faster depending upon what they're trying to go back to. Non-contact sports, you know, generally probably around, you know, 4 months. Throwing probably doesn't need to start until before, or until after 4 months. AC joint injuries, so kind of the other spectrum in the shoulder. Again, generally a traumatic injury. This is typically a fall onto an outstretched shoulder or direct blow. These can generally be identified fairly easily, at least when someone doesn't have pads on, but sometimes can be a little more difficult with a full set of shoulder pads, differentiating this between a stinger or a clavicle fracture or even a shoulder dislocation. And obviously things can occur together. You know, ideally you want to rule out a stinger, and then treatments based upon a degree of separation. So the classification that most of us have seen is, you know, 1 through 6, typically the low grade, 1 and 2 can be managed non-operatively. Once you get to a higher grade, with more of a quote unquote bump, is when potential surgical intervention starts to, be discussed, but oftentimes can be reserved, depending upon, again, function and degree of, separation. So a good set of x-rays is really key in differentiating this. You know, a lot of, unfortunately, ER locations, you know, won't do appropriate shoulder radiographs. They'll do radiographs supine or laying down. That really doesn't give the gravity separation on this. So when you're really basing these things, a lot of times you actually have to repeat the x-rays that come in and not just rely on what was done in another institution. You want to rule out fracture. You want to rule out dislocation. And again, posterior dislocation needs to be ruled out pretty much in almost all shoulder injuries with the appropriate x-rays. If you can get bilateral x-rays, that oftentimes will give you at least a side-to-side comparison, because again, sometimes with angling of the beam, this can be a little difficult. And treatment, low-grade ones, you know, symptomatic. So some people miss minimal time. Some people, depending upon their pain tolerance and again, demands, especially throwers, may take a little bit longer. We're all familiar now with, you know, athletic taping, which some people find at least helps with that proprioceptive, you know, muscular control to help hold things in place. Donut pads for athletes, injections, you know, probably not in a young high school group, but, you know, obviously much more utilized in the college and professional ranks. Grade 3 injury is probably the controversy with the advent of more surgical techniques. I think you have more doctors offering surgery for people acutely for this. Most of these don't need surgery because there are significant complications that can occur with surgery. Return to sports is really 4 to 6 months after surgery for one of these things, and most people will get better. So it's probably reasonable to at least have a trial of non-operative treatment, because most people will get better, and if they do fail, then you can consider surgery to address any sort of functional complaints, especially with overhead activity or heavy lifting. High-grade injuries, which are generally going to be this grade 5, you know, again, probably need to be considered for surgical treatment. There's not a surgical emergency for any of these things unless there's some sort of neurovascular event, which is probably going to be more on your high-energy car accident, fall from a height type event. But again, you know, a 4 to 6 month recovery, and again, significant complications. The one on the bottom is actually someone who presented with 2 prior failed surgeries. And again, these become challenging, and especially dealing with multiple holes in the clavicle and a contact athlete who's going to get hit or fall on that, you're just waiting for a fracture, to occur. So, you know, unfortunately, industry has probably driven surgery for this and surgical techniques for this, and I think there's starting to be a swing back, hopefully, to maybe not operating on so many of them, even though they're fun surgeries. And obviously there's a whole bunch of different ways, but in the ideal world, you're trying to minimize, you know, the number of holes through the clavicle into something fairly small, and then plus or minus adding grafts in, just like ACL surgery, if they're more of a chronic appearance. So post-surgery, again, you want to go slow on these. A slight loss of reduction is very common, so I think this needs to be spoken to your patients prior to the operation, that it's not uncommon in probably a quarter to a third of people to lose a little bit of function. Briefly, clavicle fracture, so again, more of a traumatic fall or blow to the shoulder. Again, initially, these were all treated non-operatively. There was a swing towards fixing them all, and now I think the swing is going back to, hey, maybe not all these need surgery, although in these higher displaced, comminuted, shortened fractures, these probably will get better faster with the surgery, and ideally you don't want to deal with a Tony Romo issue of, you know, healed, break, and miss, you know, a season and a half. Most of these that are minimally displaced can be treated non-operatively, sling for comfort, protected motion, progress activity. Once they have no tenderness at the fracture site and radiographic signs of healing, they can probably return to play. Although contact activity, you probably want to base on complete radiographic healing. Surgical treatment reserved for more significant injuries. Again, there is a risk of hardware removal at a second surgery, but potentially in some of these really bad fractures, you actually may heal faster with surgery than without surgery. And then obviously a return back to contact is going to be longer than non-contact. You see a lot of these cyclists who wreck their bikes, have a fix, and they're riding within, you know, a week or two. So briefly, because I know we're short on time, atraumatic injuries, which is generally, you know, pain in throwers or overuse injuries. Again, baseball is typically where we're looking at this, but again, it's any overhead sport, so tennis, swimming, volleyball. The shoulder has extreme motions placed on it with that swinging or throwing type motion, and repetitive stresses, especially in cocking and follow through, are exhibited and can cause a predictable set of injuries. So most of these individuals have pain. They may have loss of velocity, loss of control. They generally only hurt when they're actually throwing. And so you kind of need to figure out when it hurts, where it hurts, what they've done for it, what aggravates it, what makes it better. Exam-wise, again, in this young group, it's basically the same as the adult exam. Most of these kids really don't do much from a stretching standpoint, so a lot of them have internal rotation tightness. There is some physiologic bony change that occurs in young throwers that allow them to have increased external rotation. So even though they may be asymmetric internally, that may just be how their bony structure is. So some of this is adaptive, some of this is acquired. Radiographs, you know, usually are probably adequate. The question is imaging. Most people think they need an MRI for everything that they walk into the office for, which is fine to get, although it's probably not going to change a lot of your management, at least initially, because most of these things need to be managed non-operatively, as surgical treatment is very unpredictable. In a young group with open physes, comparison views on the left, this was a kid with a little leak shoulder who came in with kind of vague lateral shoulder pain. Doesn't look too bad until you shoot the right side, and that looks different. So it took that to convince mom and dad, hey, we need to shut him down, because this is a real problem. So little league shoulders, I know y'all talked about elbow yesterday. So it's basically a stress fracture. Physeal strength decreases as testosterone increases. So actually, as you start to enter puberty, this is when this occurs. Diffuse shoulder pain, you need to eliminate throwing. You can start a progressive rehab program to work on motion, work on strength, work on core and lower body, throwing mechanics, and then a gradual return to play. If you continue to throw, this is a problem that you start to worry about, is a fracture through the physis, and often these actually need surgery. So this is the good scare, is hey, if you don't stop throwing, you can actually break through your growth plate. So a lot of times if they're trying to play first base or trying to play outfield with this, they're not doing the adequate rest. Slap lesions, which is the bane of all throwers and overhead athletes. Again, pain usually at that extreme cocking, loss of velocity. We're generally treating these non-operatively. And then rotator cuff and impingement, generally seen in the older population with pain and weakness. Again, treatment is to restore motion, improve pain and strengthening. And then from just a general consensus, you know, you need to tailor these to your athletes or your surgeries, recover motion, especially internal rotation, and then strengthen everything. It's not just the shoulder. It's not just the scapula. It's the core. It's the lower extremity. And then progress through a graduated rehab program.